This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now download as a podcast off our website at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have with me in the studio Philip Gurevich. He's the author of the prize-winning and haunting book on Rwanda, We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Families. He's written for Granta, Harper's, The Forward, New York Review of Books, has done a lot of writing for The New Yorker, and currently, he's the editor of the Paris Review. Philip Gurevich, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Good to be here.
Say, I read that your parents or grandparents were Holocaust survivors.
Well, you read wrong. You read right, but you were it was misreported. My parents and my grandparents separately came over to this country as refugees during World War II. But Holocaust survivor obviously implies that they were rounded up at some point or put in a concentration camp or endured their attempted extermination in Europe. And the reality is that they fled fascist Europe and got here alive and well. And so that's really the only accurate description of the family history.
And has that experience affected you, or do you think that's too much of a stretch?
Luckily, it was not my own experience. My parents came here in time that my father, for instance, went to school here in Madison as an undergraduate. And then they met in Chicago. They had come here very separately in their youths. And I would say that a certain awareness of the way in which a private political life and vast historical events can intersect affected me. The fact that on one side of my family, on my father's side of the family, my grandfather was politically engaged. He was a Menshevik in Russia and in exile and across Europe. And frankly, he spent a good deal of time being chased around or locked up by various Nazi governments or occupations, but always specifically as a political, not as a Jew. I mean, he was Jewish, but nobody really cared. They were more interested in him as a political. So when I say a refugee, I mean it quite specifically. Of course, that stuff influences one, but I don't sort of feel like, I don't practice my father's profession, and I don't sing as well as my mom, and so forth. I don't feel that we're just simply subsets, and that it's genetic or something at all.
No, I don't believe that for a minute, really. But I'm thinking of my predecessor, Erwin Knoll, who fled Vienna himself, was a refugee, and his father too, who I knew. And I'm also thinking of a sister-in-law of mine, whose mother was a Holocaust survivor, and my sister-in-law almost has her bag packed, ready to go anytime there's expecting a knock on the door. That might be a little bit of a stretch, but she has told me, she feels that insecure sometimes.
I suppose actually what I was brought up with was something kind of different, and it was an awareness of that probably does inform a certain amount of my international political writing, which is, sometimes people look at places like the places I've written about, Rwanda, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, wherever it is, and they say, man, that place is abnormally messed up.
North Korea, too.
And actually, I always say, well, maybe it is or maybe it isn't, but I think that we're actually abnormally comfortable and that this country is actually the anomaly. And probably the experience of my parents' difficulties, without making me jingoistic in the least, made me appreciative. I was brought up to understand by people who had spent much of their life paperless, without papers, without passports, the value of an American passport, specifically an American one, and in ways that are very different, by the way, from the generation before me, although they live in this country. I've always been somewhat skeptical of Europe. I've never had a Europe fetish of any kind. I've always thought they wanted to wipe us out. And they don't deserve us back. And they have a lot to answer for. And when I hear Europeans say, tut, tut, I cannot believe the things that happened in Rwanda and my goodness, what happened in Cambodia, they say it happened in your parents' generation right there. So I've always felt in some way that a certain awareness of these things has made me regard and be careful of some of the things that in this country are quite extraordinary. Which also makes one need to defend them when they're under threat.
What things do you think are under threat, if any, right now?
Well, actually, at this point, I think we're in a period where both nationally and internationally, to a large degree, the mindset, and it's interesting that you started the show with a question you did because it sort of fits this theory, but that the mindset that's defined our understanding of left and right, our understanding of international power, our understanding of sort of global systems, our understanding of domestic politics and the party system and how all of these things work is essentially a post-World War II series of consensus. And that's gone through various shifts after the Cold War, domestically and internationally. But that basically right now we're in a strange period where those old models don't hold and they're not working very well. And yet new models have not yet arisen. We're still using language. We're still using formulas that make us think about our relationship to other countries. This plays into the question of, you know, are we or aren't we in an age of terror? And does the age of terror substitute for the Cold War sort of bipolar world? It happens domestically in terms of, you know, we're in a situation where we have a decadent right-wing Republican Party that is at this particular moment in time in the mid-fall of 2006, starting to look like it's at 5.
2005.
Starting to look like it's tearing itself apart a little bit, but there is no opposition party. This is not really a kind of a working system where you have somebody to take the place of the party that seems to be very, very poorly handling its own power. And so I think we're in a time when a lot that we've taken for granted, we don't actually have a good vocabulary for. We don't quite know how to think about it. I know a lot of people who are very good at explaining what they're discontent with and what they're worried about. I see very few people who can point to what they think they might do about it.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with the author and the editor, Philip Gurevich, who's the editor of the Paris Review now. And he's the author of an incredible book on Rwanda. We wish to inform you that tomorrow we will be killed with our families. And he's written for The New Yorker, among many other magazines. No opposition party, you said. Now, you covered the race in 2004. You covered the Kerry campaign. And
Bush, too.
Were you surprised at the outcome?
No, I wasn't actually surprised at the outcome because it seemed to me that the way I like to put it is Bush did very, very poorly for a wartime president who ran unopposed.
And Kerry didn't oppose him on the Iraq War?
Kerry did not oppose him on the important issues of the day, period. I was following the campaign around and I used to ask his foreign policy advisors quite a bit why he never raised Abu Ghraib as an issue. This is a man who had actually spoken eloquently as a young man about the risks of the overextension of American force and American power in Vietnam and had understood that issue and identified it, that that there was a danger to America both in failing to stand up to enemies and also in overreaching in the use of its power and in failing to hold up its own standards. A line that, in fact, made him very close to McCain in his recent remarks about why one should re-outlaw torture by American forces, where McCain said, you know, as a prisoner of war in Vietnam, one of the things that kept us going was the idea that this isn't what we do to prisoners of war, that should not have been an issue, that Supreme Court nominations never managed to become an issue, that Kerry failed to defend himself when he was attacked by these Swift boat ads. In other words, failed in some sense to really recognize how politics was working in his moment and to be able to fight it, that he failed in any meaningful way to deal with foreign policy, and that he seemed in some way very scattered. Mm-hmm. This struck
out
me.
Out of touch, certainly.
Out of touch, unable to connect. The fact of the matter is that I don't know what it's like in Madison, but certainly nowhere that I've been have I run into anybody who is a disappointed Kerry supporter.
Those bumper stickers have been taken off, most of those by now.
Yeah, and I don't find that there's somebody else who's replaced that. It's not just Kerry.
Well, what I was going to ask. There seems to be this assumption that Hillary Clinton is the putative nominee, and I, for one, am not in that camp, and I'm wondering if you think that's a foregone conclusion or that's the likely thing that's going to happen?
What kind of
candidate you think she'd be?
I'm from New York State, and I did not like the way at the time, just as a watching it happen, that by virtue of having been first lady and being powerful, she came in and sort of bigfooted the nomination for the senatorial race away from Anita Lowey. I mean, people say, well, it's good to have a woman in the Senate. Well, guess what? The candidate was going to be a woman.
And she'd paid her dues, too.
And she'd paid her dues, and she'd done all her legwork, and nobody had anything against her. She just bigfooted her as a celebrity. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton's been a hell of a senator. I mean, nobody seems to reproach her for that, including, interestingly, a number of Republicans who certainly were predisposed to, they had their baseball bats ready if bashing was to be done. And they basically say, she's been serious and she's informed and she somehow doesn't seem to tweak some of the same hostilities that her president husband did. I don't see it as a foregone conclusion. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
It's a long way off.
It's a long way off. Too long. And we have a dangerously lame duck situation shaping up in this country. And the absence of an opposition party, to my mind right now, is much more troubling, not in terms of the question of who's going to be the Democratic candidate in 2008, but that right now, when you have a deeply, deeply troubled administration that seems utterly incapable of responding to Katrina, to Iraq, to its own threat of indictments of many people in power all around it, that seems basically without initiative, unable to impose party discipline, and yet, has this monopoly on power as a party, and there's nobody there to take up the slack. There's nobody there to somehow fill that void. There's nobody there to articulate in a coherent way. Of course, there's some people, but there's not a sort of force. There's not a coordinated presence. That seems to me to be not just troubling as somebody who'd like to have somebody to vote for. It's troubling when you try to see where does this country go and how does it kind of rescue itself from a pretty bad slide.
I'm speaking with Philip Gurevich. You said in some interview that your goal is not to change the world, but I don't really believe you, or believe maybe that wasn't an accurate quote, but were you being modest there, or are you serious about that?
I'm serious about that.
And what do you mean? Because I take a different view, not to be grandiose about it, but I'm doing journalism in hopes to, push things along in a better way.
Oh, there's probably some quiet head. There's certainly a heads up side to what I do as a journalist. I definitely am interested in covering things that are poorly covered. The election was a tremendous exception, and I didn't like covering American politics. I felt it was overcovered, and it was very hard to cover it was hard to cover in the way that it was being covered. It was totally depressing to watch this idea that access matters. Basically talking to politicians struck me as one of the most depressing things you could do because they lie.
And also they're on automatic rewind too.
Yeah, but even then they're like, they could be on automatic rewind and say something good. They're on automatic rewind and they're lying. And a lot of the time. And I don't mind the world and I don't always have a solution. My job is to describe the world and to, as closely as I can, depict and make vivid and make palpable and make thought-provoking big, troubling questions about the way it works that we have and sort of find a way to think about them. But to come to an end, to have an answer to each question strikes me as in some way not only not my job, but probably if I were to do that, it would be in the way of my doing my job as a reporter and a writer as well. And that's not a cop out. I mean, I know it can sound like, oh well, but I'm not. I'm not trying to be lead a movement or start a tide. And even on this sort of big, big question that a lot of people assume that I have a lot of people think I have a position on it, but a lot of people think different things about what my position is, which is say international intervention in something like a genocide, like in Rwanda. I'm somewhat agnostic and ambivalent about it.
Let's talk about that. Though I think reporting things accurately and letting people confront tough questions may be just a precondition for people to taking it upon themselves to change the world in the way they feel.
Yeah, my idea is, at the very least, I can do my best to make sure that people are a little bit informed before they act.
So why don't what is your view on Rwanda? Should there have been an intervention? That seems to be the thrust of your book, but maybe I'm reading it wrong.
I would not say that that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that, to my mind, what I will say completely unambiguously is that the false promise, when we extend a false promise of protection, that pisses me off. We are not doing ourselves any honor by the rhetorical pretense of coming to the rescue. And we are actually endangering endangered people further by encouraging them to make calculations based on our promise of protection and then reneging. The safe haven of Srebrenica is sort of the, you know, petri dish example where you can see it all in the palm of your hand. There it was. We told them, this is your safe haven. Come here, little Bosnians. Gather under our flag. Gather under our protection. And in fact, all we were doing is putting them in the technical sense of the word, a concentration camp, a point of concentration where they could be more easily killed. In Rwanda, the debate about whether or not we should intervene was not really kosher, because the fact is we were there. The UN was there, and there was an intervention when the genocide broke out.
But it was a half-assed
The debate was to withdraw. The Clinton administration's policy was to pull out. I thought that was cowardly, and it was certainly a contradiction of the rhetoric, and it was dishonestly done. I think it is the bipartisan policy of pretty much, in other words, of pretty much anybody in power right now. Bush will say, we got no, you know, the Republicans in Bosnia said we got no dog in that fight, famously. Bush, during the first campaign in the debate with Gore, said, if Rwanda were to happen again, God forbid, I would not do anything. I hate to agree with Bill Clinton, but I would do what he did, nothing. Gore went on and on about how he'd do all this stuff. I thought Gore was the liar in that case. They agree. They won't do anything. The difference is one will say that they'll do something. The other will hedge about it. Now, the Bush people have now adopted the rhetoric of humanitarian intervention, but it's bogus. And so what we've seen now is a kind of depletion of the rhetorical value of these things that we actually – these ideas we hold dear without any kind of action to match it. And that actually puts us in a really dangerous and kind of nebulous spot.
What was it like to do a reporting in Rwanda? You say you were one of the few journalists there when you got there 1 year after the genocide.
Yeah, it was great. I'm not a war reporter. People think I'm a war reporter because I go to places where there were wars. I'm an aftermath guy more. Obviously in the aftermath it can be a little dicey, but it was not I had no idea what to expect. You know, my images of Rwanda were like black and white sets like for Waiting for Godot or something. You know, one bear tree and an emaciated man in the corner. And in fact, it's a lush, beautiful country that had repaired at least enough of itself relatively quickly that what I was interested in was coming in that little calm after the storm where people weren't quite back on their feet yet, but they were just secure enough that they could start to talk.
Well, that's a fascinating moment, isn't it? I remember reading a book by Milton Mayer, who was associated with the Progressive for many years, now dead, unfortunately, who went to Germany shortly after the end of World War II and wrote a book called They Thought They Were Free. And he talked to Germans, average, everyday German, about, you know, what did you make of that furnace over there that was burning people up? And, you know, why did you go along with it? And so people would go into their denial and all of that. And you wrestled with the same thing. In fact, you talked to some of the villains. I know I saw an interview where you say you do like to write about villains and all their complexity. Mm-hmm. And how is it?
Villains are interesting. Villains are interesting for one reason. Good, what I call good villains, as in not their villainy is good, but that they're good as characters, are people who are not apologetic entirely about their villainy, but are actually don't even necessarily believe their villainy is villainy. Their villainy is conspicuous to us. But they are ideologues who believe that what they're doing that's bad is actually good. So people don't commit genocide because they think, let's get together and kill a lot of people and murder's bad, but what the hell? They're not hitmen in their own minds. They get together to fulfill a utopian ideal. They create an ideological sort of superstructure for the whole thing. And the idea is not, let's mess up the society and trash the place. It's let's fix up this messed up place and purify it. And that's why people say things like final solution. What's on the other side of a final solution? A solved problem. What could be better? You know? It's very different from saying, you know, I know it's a sin and I know it's a crime and it's a dirty little thing and let's sneak around and do it in the dark.
Yeah, but there are two kinds of characters, or there are more than two kinds, but the two kinds I want to talk about in the book are those that actually were involved actively in ordering the massacres or carrying them out, and then the people who didn't really do much about it. And you talk about both. You talk about this pastor who then went to live in Laredo, Texas, of all mm-hmm. places, and he was responsible for the death of a couple thousand people, maybe as many as 6,000 or 8,000 of his own flock, some of them. And
he was involved, certainly. I don't know. I mean, responsible makes it sound like he killed them. He was involved in encouraging Tutsis who were threatened with for their lives to congregate in the church as a sort of sanctuary, like, go here, it'll be okay. And then he was involved in bringing the militia to kill them. And he was subsequently convicted in the UN court in Tanzania of crimes of genocide, and he's in the slammer over there now.
What was it like to meet him in Texas? That must have been wild.
He didn't really want to be found, you know. I mean, I was in Rwanda, and I was in way western Rwanda. Well, what happened, I was in Rwanda, and I met a guy who had worked for the FBI and was now working as a – it was like a New York cop. He had actually worked on the 93 World Trade Center bombing. I met him at a bar. You know, not that many New York cops in Rwanda. So you're sitting at a bar, you see a guy who looks like a New York cop, and he sounds like a New York cop. You talk to him. And he said he was working on this case and this and that. And I had heard this rumor. He said, there's one case that's kind of interesting on an American angle. And I'd heard this rumor that there was a Rwandan in Laredo. So I asked him about it. And he said, yeah, that's the case. How'd you know about it? And so it was one of those little journalistic moments where the guy – kind of gives away a little bit because you knew a little bit more than – or anyway, you sounded like you knew more than you do. So I found out that there was this case, and so I went out to the area that he came from in western Rwanda, and people all said, oh, yeah, he's living in Laredo, Texas. So I went down to Laredo, Texas, and I tried to find him. But, you know, I mean, on one level, it seemed like this was going to be easy because I arrived in Laredo and looked around and realized there were, like, no black people in Laredo, period. There were – it's a Mexican town mostly, and there weren't that many white people either, it seemed to me. But, you know, it was really quite conspicuous that if I could find – and I was told that he was working in a health food store. And in Laredo, it turns out that all the stores that call them health food stores are really these apotecarias, these, like, you know, Mexican – you know, impotence and digestion herbal cure stores. I really couldn't see him sort of selling under-the-counter Viagra in like a store that's all Spanish-speaking. This guy was like a serious church father at the top of the hierarchy in Rwanda, barely spoke English. But I learned that his son was a doctor. And there turned out to be a whole lot of hospitals in Laredo, and I kept calling and calling. And finally I figured out that he had his name had changed. He had not to hide, but because his name had like 14 syllables and he knocked it down to two, and the first two. And I found his house, and actually I did something which I'd never done before. I just sat in a hotel room at night and I called information over and over and asked for a street address. And they say they can't give it to you and because they can't. And I asked them over and over and over and over and over. I just kept asking until finally I got a woman who said, oh yeah, sure, honey, and gave me the number, the street address. And I drove to the house and I found the son. And I found actually the wife who was Rwandan of the son, the daughter-in-law. And, you know, they were very welcoming. And then the father-in-law, the pastor, just suddenly decided, I want to speak. I am innocent and I will defend my name. He had no idea that I was informed.
And was he lying to himself or was he just lying to you?
That's always difficult to know. Because it's quite easy to lie to yourself in a situation like that. A well-constructed genocidal order is one in which it's quite easy to lie to yourself because you can think that it's a time of national emergency and it's a time of heightened passions and it's a time in which the line between protecting people and suddenly being seen as the person who herded them into a certain spot is very gray and fine. And because you've been nice to some of the people who later get killed at other times in your life, I think he was lying to both. Mm-hmm. But I think he was lying to me more blatantly than probably he could lie to himself.
Well, it's pretty blatant when he said there's nobody I tried to help more than Tutsis. I mean, that was kind of...
Yeah, he was lying. And he did not, on the other hand, he did not sound persuasive. Mm-hmm. I mean, in other words, he basically said, well, these terrible things happened, but I was just hiding in my house. And by the time I came out, everybody was gone. And I think at that point, his son and his lawyer realized this was just not a good move.
Probably not a good move either to give you the translation of that letter from people in his
church. He's the one who gave me the title of my book.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. He gave me a letter which it contained the phrase written to him I had heard this story in Rwanda. Everywhere I went in that little town that he came from, the people who had survived the massacre had said to me, you know, there were a group of Tutsi pastors who were inside this church who wrote to him, the Hutu pastor who had herded them into this church, and they'd become the leaders of the flock inside the church. And they'd wrote to him asking him to help. And he didn't help. He told them, you must die. And whether he told them that exactly or whether he said, I can't do anything, and it amounted to that. And I'd heard about this letter, and I'd heard about this letter. So I just asked him, did you ever get a letter? And he said, oh, yeah, sure. You know, there's no secret. That was the letter that was sent to me. And I said, what did it say? And he said, well, I happen to have it here. He had actually held on to this letter after traveling out of Rwanda in the aftermath of the genocide into Zaire, down to Zambia, from Zambia to Laredo. I mean, the guy obviously this was what was interesting. He considered the letter exculpatory. He thought that the letter basically showed that the Tutsis had trusted him and had asked him for something impossible, but that even unto their deaths, they saw him as his possible savior, not as an enemy.
As a reporter, you must have almost jumped out of your seat there, getting that document.
I basically tried to jump out of the house before they took it back. Yeah, I got out of there very quickly.
I mean, that's something that's hard to come by. And then talk just briefly about the people who were not in his position of power, who just did not exercise free will. I'm sure a lot of the listeners have seen Hotel Rwanda, and you talk about Paul from the hotel there, who's the star of the movie, the character anyway. And you say he exercised free will, and he was astonished that, and you were too, evidently, that not more people exercised free will in opposing this. Why is that? What's the riddle to that?
People are weak. People are weak and people are self-serving. And I mean, you know, one of the problems is that, you know, all the Holocaust literature, not the Holocaust literature, but the Holocaust movies like Schindler's List or a lot of the kind of the way that we present these stories to ourselves or even a story like Paul's essentially encourages us to imagine that we will – I mean, Americans tend to say, yeah, I'd identify with the good guy. You know, you don't identify with the weak coward. You identify with John Wayne. You know, you identify with the good guy and the guy who has honor and justice. But the reality is that in these situations, when the societal breakdown is sufficient and the culture is such and the whole mechanism has been developed over a long period of time, most people are weak and will sell out and betray all but those very, very near to them and even some of those. And people are very, very dangerous to other people.
That is a chilling conclusion. I mean, we don't have much time left. Do you assume then that the genocidal impulses in all of us or the possibility of genocide exists in every society, or it's
I think
more
it's
confined
societal,
than that?
Yeah, sure. It obviously is part of the human condition. It's happened too often in too many places with too much similarity to consider it so alien. But I do think that there's a big difference between a society that's been geared up for it over many years like Rwanda and a society like our own. I mean, in Rwanda, there was literally one radio station. And in this country, if they say kill your neighbor, you can turn the channel.
Well, that is something to keep in mind. And it also is a little bit of a harrowing tale, more than a little bit harrowing. I've been speaking with Philip Gurevich. He's the author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow Will Be Killed with Our Families. He's now the editor of the Paris Review, Philip Gurevich. Thanks for being my guest.
It's a pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.